from KNX News 97.1 FM.
This is Countdown 2025.
Here are Charles Feldman and Margaret Carrero.
Well, we're back. Couldn't keep us away with just 2 weeks to go until inauguration. It is the first show of 2025 for Countdown 2025. Thank you for joining us once again. On today's show, we are going to dive into the brewing Republican civil war over whether businesses should be hiring foreign workers over American ones. Then we are going to look back at 4 years ago today, January the 6th, 2021. What actually happened that day? Two political parties and two different versions of what happened. But first, this.
It was a much different day on Capitol Hill on this January 6th compared to 4 years ago. Congress has certified President-elect Donald Trump as the winner of the 2024 election without challenge. Lawmakers convened under heavy security and even a snowstorm to certify the vote, with the reading of the electoral results from the states coming swiftly.
Donald J. Trump of the state of Florida has received 312 votes.
And yes, that was Vice President Kamala Harris presiding over the certification and reading the results. We are going to have much more on this coming up later in the show.
President Biden will ban new offshore oil and gas drilling along most U.S. coastlines, including along Southern California. Now, the move is considered mostly symbolic, as it will not impact areas where oil and gas development has currently started. It mainly covers zones where drillers have no important prospects.
And President-elect Trump has moved to indefinitely postpone this week's sentencing in his hush money case as he appeals a ruling that upheld the verdict.
Elon Musk has upset many Trump supporters by arguing in favor of the so-called H-1B visa program that allows companies to hire highly skilled foreign workers. Musk argues these workers are valuable and are needed to build up companies. President-elect Trump sides with Musk on this issue. But many of Trump's supporters are upset about this. They say the visa program takes away valuable jobs from equally skilled American workers. Sarah Blackwell is an employment law attorney and founder of Project U.S. Workers. She's represented U.S. citizens and permanent residents who were replaced by people with H-1B visas. Sarah, thanks.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So your main issue with the H-1B visa program essentially is as simple as what? That it just takes away jobs from Americans?
No, actually, and your intro was wonderful. I actually do a lot of work with the H-1B workers as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea of the program is amazing. You bring in workers where we need the workers and someone in a foreign country is qualified and you bring them to the United States to do the work. And I presume that's what Elon Musk was talking about. The purpose of the H-1B is, I mean, it's beneficial for everyone, the American company, the American workers, the foreign workers, the America as a whole. The problem is the way that the law is written, it is allowed to be used in a way that actually enslaves these workers to the employer. Most of these H-1B workers being brought in are being brought in by four or five specific companies. They are getting most of the H-1B workers so that the companies that actually need workers aren't getting them because it's a lottery system and there's only a limited number. These big companies, many of them actually owned by Indians, are bringing in a majority of the workers are from India. The problem with that is that to get a green card on a work visa from India, you have to wait like 130 years. It's an extreme amount of time. Right. So they can't have a green card. So they have to stay with this one employer or find another employer that will sponsor them. And to find that's extremely hard.
So is that what you mean when you said that they are enslaved? Because that's a pretty strong word, that they are enslaved by the employer.
Yes.
Is that what you mean?
Okay. Yes. So many of them are, you know, they contact you. If you're in this world, they contact you, say that the wages are extremely low, way lower than the American workers that are doing the same work. They're working many, many hours. They can't change jobs because they don't have another sponsor and they can't get their green card, where someone from another country doesn't have the same wait period. So they can get out of that company eventually within a year or two. It's not that big of a deal. But for these Indian workers, they end up working for these companies that are abusing them. And that is a problem. And at the same time, it drives the wages down for the other workers that are from other countries or American workers. And these companies that are using this business model, it's a business model that can be used by all American companies, not just those five. Those five, like if you work for an American company and they say, look, we'll take all your accounting, you ship your accounting to us and we will, what are you paying your wages for your workers now? We'll cut that in half. And so you can't really have an employment discrimination case because they didn't fire the Americans and hire people from one specific country or from, different countries. They just got rid of their accounting department altogether. And now they outsource it to these other companies and they're getting the accounting work for half the price.
Sarah, I have a question for you. I wonder what kind of changes you would like to see to this H-1B visa program? Because you said that you've represented kind of people on both sides, right? American workers as well as those who have the H-1B visas. What kind of changes would you like to see with this new incoming Trump administration?
I mean, he has had really great advisors. I know Ron Hira, he works, he's a professor. He has written books and actually he is Indian. He's written many books and he does all kinds of papers on it. He's brilliant. I mean, there are very...
Yeah, but what sort of changes would you want?
Well, I would have the whole H-1B system changed as far as what is required, what, how many you can get per company. I mean, there's a lot of technical changes that would fix this loophole and give the purpose of it. I don't think you need to even limit the number or lower the number. I think you can even keep that same number if you do it in the proper right way and have these like safeguards so that these companies like Infosys and TCS and Cognizant can't just take them all up and then use it to hurt the American companies and hurt the workers and hurt the American people. I mean, the only people who are winning are the shareholders, the people, the CEOs. And, I've actually talked to workers managers who've had to like tell all the workers you're fired and we're, training these other people to do your jobs. And they said it was terrible for us. So we didn't want to do it, but our competitors are doing it. So they've lowered prices that we can't compete with unless we also do these business models that these other people are doing. So, I mean, it's pushing companies that don't even want to participate into doing it to compete, and everybody loses out. So I do agree with Elon Musk in the sense that this works when it's working in the proper way.
Okay, we're talking with Sarah Blackwell, who is an employment law attorney and founder of Project U.S. Workers. Sarah, though, as you know, there are many Trump supporters who really don't want the H-1B program at all. They think it's actually kind of almost a rejection of some of the things, principles that they voted for Trump for originally, which was to not have foreign workers replace American workers under any circumstances. But I gather you don't agree with that.
Well, the H-1B isn't supposed to replace anyone. It's supposed to fill a void where there.
But it does in some cases, doesn't
does,
it?
Yes, right. Yeah, so I do agree with changing the H-1B to not replace American workers. But yeah, I don't see any reason why we would get rid of visas as long as they are done in the way that they are supposed to be. They're written in practice. Like the purpose of the H-1B isn't a bad thing, I don't believe. I think we should have chances. And I've actually, I worked as an immigration lawyer in my past and applied for a work visa for someone who was trying to bring in someone who could pick koi fish when they were first born to tell you which ones are going to be, award-winning koi fish. And we didn't have that person, but because we were only applying for one, it was impossible to get it because these other companies that are abusing it were sucking all the 85,000 that were available. So I don't agree with getting rid of it. I think it just should be fixed.
So, Sarah, I had read somewhere where you had said that the only people who benefit from this are the billionaire executives. And so I wonder how you feel about Elon Musk and the likes of himself and Vivek Ramaswamy having such close ties to Donald Trump and certainly Musk's growing influence.
Honestly, I think those people who are billionaires, they are smart. They didn't get there from being dumb. So I don't see any negative in President Trump getting advice from everyone. I just hope that President Trump doesn't just listen to, Elon Musk and the people who have you know, money, but also people who are in the trenches and seeing what's going on. And in his first term, he did seem to waver. Everybody would be super excited about his stance on H-1B. And then everybody was very frustrated with people he chose. But in the end, he did an executive order and stopped a company that had federal government ties from doing this business model and making them rehire all the American workers that were being fired did not end up having to leave because he did say, you know, this isn't the way it's supposed to go. So I am not as down on him as the other people are.
All right.
I'm hopeful that he'll see the holes.
Sarah Blackwell, founder of Protect U.S. Workers. Sarah, thanks for being with us.
All right. Thank you guys for having me.
Uh-huh.
And so earlier when we were leading into Sarah, we were talking about how the president-elect Trump has wanted a judge to postpone his sentencing on Friday. Well, we have found out that that judge has denied that request to postpone his sentencing while he appeals.
Right. But of course, that isn't, as you know, Margaret, the last word. And
of course,
Trump's lawyers have already said, even before the judge's decision now, that whatever the judge said, they are going to appeal. So
right.
They are trying very desperately to put off, because they don't want the spectacle of Donald Trump being sentenced as a criminal.
Correct.
On, you know, the 10th of January and then being sworn in on the 20th of January as president of the United States. So they are determined to take it all the way up. I don't know if they can make it to the Supreme Court if they want to by
That's
the 20th.
That's a pretty short timeline.
Very short timeline. But the Supreme Court has been known at times to act very quickly when it wants to.
Okay, so again, the breaking news here on Countdown 2025, a New York judge has denied Trump's request to postpone his Friday sentencing while he appeals, and that's for the hush money case that we're talking about.
This is Countdown 2025
on KNX News, 97.1 FM.
Welcome back to the show. Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Margaret Carrero. Congress met earlier today to officially count the Electoral College ballots and certify the 2024 presidential election. Vice President Harris presided over it and read the final results.
This announcement of the state of the vote by the President of the Senate shall be deemed a sufficient declaration of the persons elected, President and Vice President of the United States.
Now, the whole thing seemed like business as usual, but of course it wasn't. There was heavy security after what happened the last time Congress tried to certify a presidential election. That was back on the 6th of January in 2021.
Now it is up to Congress to confront this egregious assault on our democracy. And after this, we're going to walk down, and I'll be there with you. We're going to walk down to the Capitol.
Now, those Trump supporters did march to the Capitol, storming the building and sending lawmakers to escape to their offices to wait out the ruckus that lasted a few hours. Order was eventually restored, and the election was certified with President Biden rightfully winning. So, with us is prominent historian Julian Zelizer from Princeton University. He's also a featured CNN analyst and co-author of the book January 6th and the Politics of History. Julian, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, they say, as I'm sure you know, that history is often written by the victors. So is history going to be recorded as a day of infamy when there is an insurrection or a day of patriotism, which is how Trump and his supporters see it?
Well, my guess is different people will continue to interpret it in different ways. But what is clear is that President-elect Trump and his narrative of patriotism, of innocence, has triumphed, at least for the time being. His election is in itself evidence that this was not the kind of traumatic event that many Democrats, you know, expected it to be. He won office, he's back in power, and my guess is you'll likely see a pardon of the January 6th insurrectionists.
Do you think that's a good move on his part, the idea of pardoning those individuals who took part in that?
It's a good political move, but it's from a historical perspective. None of this is great for the nation. You would expect that a president who did this, A, wouldn't be back in power, and B, wouldn't decide that this would be a priority in terms of essentially, relinquishing any sense of guilt for what they had done.
So let me circle back to my first question, Julian, about how, you know, history is often written by those who win. But that, of course, happened historically in a different age, different ages, when there wasn't, you know, video and there wasn't audio recordings. Why is it so difficult then nowadays in 2025 to have a unified understanding of what happened on a day that was so widely covered?
Part of it is we do have a much more fragmented media. It's not simply partisan, but it's decentralized, and there are fewer filters to information. So you can put a video out that shows violence happening at the Capitol, but other people will put out either videos of other scenes or manufactured videos that try to deny that reality. And second, you just have, in a polarized era, a very strong dynamic where partisan interests and partisan loyalty can drive how people understand the world, understand history, more than the facts themselves. And you combine those two dynamics and forces, and you get where we are today.
So I read an opinion piece that you wrote about the conclusions of the January 6th committee, and I pulled a quote from that. It was, "For anyone who continues to believe that the January 6, 2021 insurrection was exaggerated or was a haphazard, amateurish effort gone bad, the final report should throw cold water on those beliefs." We've kind of been touching on this a little bit, but what goes through your mind when you hear Donald Trump calling it a day of love?
It's pretty astounding. I think even if you are a strong supporter of Trump, you should be able to acknowledge what people saw with their very eyes. Even before the committee did its work, the violence, the aggression, the breaking into the Capitol while members were doing their work, it was all right in front of us. And so I don't think there's any way to see Trump's interpretation as accurate, but you are correct. Many people in the end are accepting that.
Julian, you said before the break, correctly, of course, that tens of millions of Americans voted for Trump, so therefore they didn't view what happened 4 years ago to the date as being a particularly dramatic time in American history, which begs the question, why didn't they?
Well, I think there is a story about the Republican Party becoming pretty radicalized from voters to elected officials, where almost anything is permissible in the name of obtaining power. And I do think part of the story is ultimately not simply seeing things in a different way, but just not caring, not seeing this as disqualifying for the leader of the country or something that a party could not engage in. So part of this is a story of the Republican Party. You know, part of this is a level at the same time of disengagement, where lots of things happen in Washington, even this, and people just assume that's all conventional, that's all status quo, and they move forward.
Moving forward, I wonder how you see January 6th, 2021 being taught in school history classes.
Well, I think it will be still taught by most historians and most textbooks as an insurrection, as a fundamentally disruptive and dangerous moment for the democracy, followed by everything we're talking about, his reelection, Republicans essentially accepting and even embracing what happened, and we'll explore why. But it's hard for me to see many serious historians ignoring the realities that are right in front of us, that were right in front of us, and that the facts from the archives will continue to bear. So part of it will be about the insurrection, and part of it will be about our discussion. Why wasn't that a breaking point for a candidate and for a party?
Princeton historian Julian Seltzer, co-author of the book January 6th and the Politics of History. Julian, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, what if President-elect Trump has to deal with another pandemic for the second time? We'll look into whether lessons learned from 2020 could be applied, will be applied today. If you miss a show, by the way, catch up on demand on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search Countdown 2025 and follow the show.